From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There was a record-shattering turnout in Tuesday's race, with more than 100 million voters having cast their ballots even before Election Day. And while Americans were warned that massive reliance on mail-in and absentee voting could mean that the race could be up in the air for days, there was a palpable sense of disappointment among progressives that millions of voters still chose a neo-fascist for president. Although he lost Texas and Florida, Joe Biden's path to the White House has strengthened, especially with the flipping of Arizona from red to blue. On Wednesday, he won Wisconsin and has just been projected to win in Michigan. Projections of a blue wave appear to have not transpired, as Democrats have barely hung on to their House majority and appear likely to remain a minority in the Senate. Even hopes of flipping many state houses from red to blue fell short. We turn now to John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, host of the podcast Next Left. He's a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, an associate editor of The Capital Times, author of numerous books, including Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse and The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Welcome to the program, John.
Such a pleasure to be with you, Sonali.
So as of now, the New York Times is calling the election, saying that they're basically counting Michigan and Wisconsin and saying that Biden has 253 electoral college votes. Fox News is giving him Biden the highest total, saying that he has 264 electoral college votes. But AP, which is what many journalists trust and is sort of seen as a standard bearer, is now matching, okay, just as if seconds ago, matching Fox. So as of now, as if you and I speaking, basically Biden is 6 electoral college votes away from winning the presidency, and a win in Nevada would give him that, right?
That is correct. And there's a couple of routes in there, and there's still a lot of votes that are being counted. In places that are starting to resurface in attention, a place like Georgia, where there's still a substantial amount of votes to be counted. Obviously, there's a lot of sturm and drang as regards Pennsylvania. So we'll watch it come. But I think what you're getting at, Sonali, and I agree with the assessment, is that it certainly looks at this point like Joe Biden has the clearest route to an electoral college win to go with what is now emerging as an overwhelming popular vote win. So that is sort of putting the pieces together. And I always think we underestimate the role of the popular vote nationally and somewhat overestimate electoral college, knowing full well that electoral college is the route into the presidency. But I do see quite a few things coming together for Mr. Biden.
So clearly voters were motivated to vote against Trump. Exit polls show that there was a lot of enthusiasm for beating Trump rather than enthusiasm for Biden. Does that explain why Democrats as a whole didn't see that projected Senate and House win? Of course, they still have a House majority, but they actually eroded their majority a little bit, and that Senate win didn't transpire. Is that explained by the fact that Americans went to Biden because that was the way to beat Trump and not because they got excited about the Democratic Party?
I totally believe that. And in fact, I think that's exactly the reality and also the great challenge of the moment. What you end up here with is a situation where after, in many ways, 4 years of the Democratic Party saying Trump is the worst thing ever and we have to stop him, they appear to have succeeded in convincing a clear majority of the electorate that is indeed the case. And in fact, it looks like getting toward a place where they can convince enough people in battleground states to achieve a victory. But when you frame everything around this argument that the other guy's really bad, you end up, I think, losing a portion of your potential votes. And let me give you just a real concrete example of it. In Florida, many progressives, many Democrats had their first big disappointment of election night when a state that many polls had suggested was in play, a possible pickup for the Democrats, a possible pickup for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, Donald Trump and Mike Pence opened up a substantial lead early on, and it never really dissipated. They you know, opened it up to a point where they won the state pretty quickly. And so you think, well, okay, Florida, much more conservative than you thought, much more pro-Trump than you thought, except at the same time, Florida was having a referendum on doing a $15 minimum wage, and that won overwhelmingly. So you end up with a situation where what are thought of as progressive policies prevailed and won a very, very high level of vote, whereas the one candidate who actually is at least somewhat supportive of a $15 minimum wage, Joe Biden, loses the state. So there's a disconnect there. There just wasn't the amplification of the issues, and I think in many ways the framing out of a clear agenda. The agenda was there in many cases on many issues, but it just wasn't central to the campaign. And I think it made it harder for Biden to connect in a number of states. I also think that it made it harder to link the presidential vote and the Senate races as effectively as obviously Biden and frankly, the Senate candidates would have liked.
Right. If you wanted to look up as a progressive what Biden stood for, going to his campaign page made a progressive happy. So it was there on paper, and it enabled progressives to, all right, we're going to vote for Biden to get rid of Trump. But if you were a moderate or someone who might be scared off by some of these issues, you don't really see it coming from Biden. Or if you were looking for Biden to make substantive policy claims, you didn't really get it from him during the campaign, whereas you had Trump harping on about how it was so important to have the economy, reset the economy. So I do want to get to the Senate because I think that's really important. But let's briefly stay on Trump. I think it can't be understated the importance of Biden very likely now having beaten Trump. That was the important part of this, the most important part of this election. Are we going to get to say goodbye to this chapter of American history? I mean, Trump, not necessarily Trumpism, but at least Trump.
You know, it looks like we're headed there. And again, whenever we have conversations like this, as somebody who's covered a lot of politics, I always warn that there are occasional surprises. About a decade ago, I covered a Supreme Court Supreme Court race in the state of Wisconsin, where it appeared that the progressive candidate had won by a very narrow margin, just a handful of votes, but everything was supposed to be in. And then 2 days later, or a day or so later, they found 7,000 uncounted ballots in a very conservative area. And, you know, that upended the whole thing. And so, you know, you have to recognize those possibilities. If we do that, if we look at it, then I think we're looking at a situation where the votes that are out, the votes that are still to be counted and where they are at, point to the likelihood that Joe Biden will, of course, it's now very, very clear, have an electoral college win with the largest vote ever for a presidential candidate of either party, and that parallel to that, will be the popular vote, largest win for any candidate ever, in that he's got the highest total. He also has a wide popular vote margin. And then parallel to that is an electoral college win, much narrower, not as dramatic, but certainly significant enough, and potentially, as the full count goes on, expanding out to something that might be comparable to or even stronger than Donald Trump's electoral college win back in 2016.
Trump claimed on Wednesday, "We have claimed for electoral vote purposes the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which won't allow legal observers, the state of Georgia, and the state of North Carolina, each one of which has a big Trump lead. Additionally, we hereby claim the state of Michigan, if in fact," and then Twitter sort of cut off this tweet, flagging it as disputed. Trump is claiming, I mean, I'm having a hard time keeping my face serious in quoting Trump, you know, in saying that he has simply claimed these states. And of course, on election night, he simply claimed that there was a victory. He has conflated the casting of ballots with the counting of ballots, which is a very neat sleight of hand trick that he is attempting to fool his base with. So where are your thoughts on Trump today?
Well, my thoughts on Trump today aren't too different than they were a couple days ago. The simple reality is that in the last really number of weeks, Donald Trump has been absolutely desperate. Going into this election, he knew he was in a very weak place with a very narrow route to victory. And I will say, to his credit, he fought it as hard as he could. He worked very, very hard. Went everywhere he possibly could to kind of find the votes in the battleground states that might clear that route to victory.
And unfortunately, probably helped spread coronavirus infections.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, there was a rally in Wisconsin, my home state, on Monday night where you just saw tons of people packed in without masks, very physically active too. Trump got there kind of late, and so they were all dancing and. You know, I'd be very shocked if there wasn't spread of coronavirus. So it's a serious issue. Yeah, Sonali, I'm going to turn something off. I apologize.
Sure. We're speaking with John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, and a very busy man, and also in great demand after the election to give commentary. And John, are you back with us?
Yeah. I sure am, and I apologize very much for that. You're right that sometimes we forget to turn our phones off between all these things. But to kind of get to the heart of what we're talking about there, you know, this Donald Trump has been desperate. He has gone out and fought very, very hard in these last few days. And, you know, he sent a signal that if he saw any route before or after the election to claiming a victory, even if it was not legitimate, he was going to do it. I mean, we weren't surprised last night. Now, what was fascinating on Tuesday night or early in Wednesday morning was not that Trump went out and did what he did, claiming a victory that he didn't have, and then extending that into Wednesday during the day with these, you know, outlandish claims of victory in places where he hasn't necessarily won, like Michigan, but what we saw that was interesting was that Joe Biden went out before him and laid down a marker. And similarly today, Joe Biden was out laying down a marker. And that's really important. That's Biden has learned something from the 2000 Bush v. Gore race, where Al Gore and the Democrats were way too cautious in speaking to the American people in clear ways about what they thought they had accomplished and how the race should be assessed. Biden's much more aggressive in that, and I think more effective on it. And that is throwing Trump off even more, because seeing Biden out there spelling out the popular vote win, talking about, you know, being ahead in key states, I think has got Trump now at a point where, you know, the Trump camp knows that it's really on a sinking ship. And they are, you know, they're at the ultimate point of desperation, sending Rudy Giuliani in. And with all due respect, I don't think it's going to work. And I think that the president looks more desperate and kind of more dysfunctional even than usual. And we still have a substantial amount of votes to count. But I would say by the end of the week, going perhaps into early next week, it's going to be very, very hard for Donald Trump to maintain the arguments that he's pushing.
Let's talk about the Senate, John. All of those projections about Democrats taking the Senate, one after the other, they lost races and they did manage to flip two seats, but then lost Doug Jones in Alabama. Mitch McConnell barely felt Amy McGrath in the very final vote count. Senator Lindsey Graham, who was quite afraid of Jamie Harrison, having fallen very far behind in raising money for his campaign, handily beat him. And Susan Collins, who was seen as one of the weakest senators, beat Sarah Gideon by quite a bit. From what I can tell, right now, the only race that is in play is North Carolina Michigan, with Gary Peters and John James. And Gary Peters, the Democratic candidate, is leading by just a few thousand votes against Republican John James. That still doesn't give Democrats anything close to even 50, or maybe they get edge up to what, 48 in the Senate?
Yeah. No, for the Democrats, it's a really rough situation. If at the end of the day, they have lost Doug Jones, so that takes them down to 46 seats. They've got to build from there. Hickenlooper in Colorado and Kelly in Arizona, that gives them two more seats. That gets them up to 48. Then if Gary Peters is in fact reelected, they're looking at 49. But that doesn't get them. I hope I'm counting right.
I think you're right, yeah. What about North Carolina? Tom Tillis is ahead of the Democrat Cal Cunningham, but, there's still votes being counted, and the difference is less than 100,000 votes.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to keep counting. You're going to keep looking for it, obviously, because, if you then get up to that 49 place, right, you're getting, kind of in the zone with that, then you're going to look to Georgia, and Georgia is going to have at least one runoff election with Reverend Raphael Warnock running against Kelly Loeffler, the appointed Republican senator in that seat. And potentially, because there's still a lot of counting going on, I believe, in Georgia, and as we speak, you're still looking at, how close Jonathan Ossoff gets to a potential runoff. And at this point, it doesn't look like he's there, but when all of it's reconciled, you might get something. So bottom line though, Sonali, is that instead of looking at a substantial pickup, right, a situation where the Democrats had a net gain of 4, 5, 6 seats, which would have, really given them a majority they could work with, they are struggling and looking at these special runoff elections, things like that, to get them to 50, right? Just to get them to the 50 they might need to then have Kamala Harris cast a tie-breaking vote. By any measure, they fell short. This is not where they wanted to be. And it is it's a really tough spot for them to be, because Joe Biden, if he does become president, but does not have a Democratic Senate, will effectively begin his presidency as a lame duck. He will have to go to Mitch McConnell to try and, do any kind of major legislative initiative. And Mitch McConnell has shown a determination to obstruct that is so extreme that you ultimately end up at a place where McConnell could define the parameters of a Biden presidency.
So two questions, John. What is Kamala Harris, as a future VP, assuming Biden wins, is she only allowed to play a tiebreaker role as vice president, or can she ever increase the Democrats' majority? And then the second question is, even without a Senate majority, can't a Biden presidency at least overturn the executive orders that Trump has signed one after the other that have been so destructive?
Absolutely. There's a lot to unpack there, all of it important. If the Democrats get to 50 seats in the Senate, then Kamala Harris, as the president of the Senate, as vice president sitting in that role, can break ties.
So only if they get to 50 seats.
They got to get to the 50. She doesn't add herself.
She's not just an extra at-large senator.
It's not that. So she's got... the fact is they need her. They need her if they get to 50.
Right.
And then she can cast a vote that even in some organizational senses could become highly significant in kind of the structures of committees, all sorts of things like that. So there's a lot to talk about there, but you got to get to that 50. Now, in the other area, which is important, when I refer to a potential President Biden as a lame duck if there's a Republican Senate, I'm obviously referring to it in the context of that executive-legislative relationship. In the core reality of the executive, there's still flexibility. as President of the United States, Joe Biden would make appointments, and many of those would have to be approved by the Senate, but there are also some positions, many positions he can fill without approval. Trump has actually done a lot of that. And yes, you can undo executive orders. That can be highly significant because Trump was very, very active in the area of executive orders. However, the important thing to understand is when Biden undoes those executive orders, right, he is bringing us maybe back to an element of normalcy, but it's hard in the areas where Biden needs to operate to do executive orders that can dramatically move us forward. And at a point where we've got the coronavirus pandemic demanding a massive stimulus, not just to fight the disease, but also to fight the mass unemployment that extends from coronavirus, at a time when we have a demand for racial justice in this country that is very loud, very clear, focused on police reforms, on criminal justice reform, but really in a much deeper sense, focused on addressing systemic racism, when we have a climate crisis that is overwhelming and coming at us in so many ways, and when we still have the reality of a budgeting process defined by a military and industrial complex and not by human needs at the level that it should be, Biden has an awfully lot he's got to do.
Right.
And without a Senate, it simply becomes very hard. You can't executive order yourself out of that corner.
John, let's talk about the bright spots for progressives on election night. One was, as I had mentioned in the news headlines, the re-election of all four members of the squad. These are the freshman congresswomen of color, incredibly progressive, eloquent, powerful spokespeople for the progressive movement in Congress. And then you had some new members that might become honorary squad members, Cori Bush, right, Jamal Bowman, Mondaire Jones, and one other whose name I'm now forgetting, Richie Torres. So, yeah. And then you had in New Mexico, I mentioned three women of color, the entire delegation going to the Congress, very, very diverse. What does that tell you? What lesson should Democrats, the Democratic establishment, take from that?
There's a lot of lessons to take from it. And you also have some other members coming out of Illinois and other states that, you know, when you add it all up, you will have a larger progressive, caucus. I anticipate it could be larger than it's been. And you'll have a much larger activist caucus. You know, the people who both identify as progressives, but are also very outspoken in bringing issues to the fore. It's clear that the Democratic base in places across the United States want this. They want a much more energetic, much more issue-focused, idea-focused, progressive Democratic representation in the House especially, but also in the Senate. Much of this extends from Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016, which really, you know, exposed a lot of possibilities and gave people a sense of what a politics might be, and then, you know, just exploded with the election in 2018, as you mentioned, of the members of the squad. People across the country see this as not just a way to achieve the political ends, you know, the winning of party primaries and general elections, but also a way to change the debate in the country and take up a whole host of issues that haven't been addressed.
Well, John, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I know you have a new piece in The Nation magazine, and we link to that from our website. Thanks so much.
It's an honor to be with you.
John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, host of the podcast Next Left. He's a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, and associate editor of Capital Times. He's also the author of numerous books. We've been discussing election results. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingup@sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.